I'm recording it, and if I'm sufficiently organized to actually turn the recorder on and off at the right time, I can put the recording up on the class webpage. All right, I've put up first where the class webpage is, just in case people want to check. It has got this PowerPoint, the previous PowerPoint, and the one before it on, as well as a couple of other links. The things that I discussed last time were those four, so I wanted to see if there were any questions about that before I went on to new stuff. Speak now or forever hold your peace, as they say in another context. All right. So this week I want to discuss Saga period Iceland, Somali law, specifically the law of Somaliland, northern Somalia, early Irish law, which we understand much less well than I would like to, and then feud law, of which all three of those are examples, and other things. We've already seen another example with the Romani. So let me start out with Iceland, which has a special place in my heart, because not only is Saga period Iceland how I got into studying weird legal systems, it is also how I got into the specialty of economic analysis of law, which is what I've been doing for the last 30-some years. And I thought I would tell you that story before I got into the substance. And it starts with an article by Gary Becker and George Stigler, both of whom at least eventually got Nobel Prizes, though not for this work, called Law Enforcement Malfeasance and Compensation of Enforcers. And I will summarize their argument not in their language, but in my language. You imagine that I'm a criminal and you're a cop and you have the goods on me. And the penalty that I will pay if I am convicted is a $100,000 fine or a term of imprisonment that's the equivalent to me of a $100,000 fine. The benefit to you for catching me is a gold star on your report card. You've done a good job. Your lifetime income will go up by $10,000. Well, Dragnet tells us what happens. I turn the evidence over to the prosecutor. You go to jail. Economics also tells us what happens. Markets exist to move resources to their highest valued use. I pay you $50,000 and you burn the evidence. So the system that we're used to using to enforce criminal law is not in the jargon of economics incentive compatible. It's not in the interest of the individuals in this system to do what they need to do for the system to work. And you then need, in effect, a second level of cops watching the first level of cops and maybe a third level watching them. And so Becker and Stigler said there's a simple and elegant solution to this problem. Stop paying the cops, and instead, when I pay a $100,000 fine, the cop gets it. Now the only bribe that he'll accept is $100,000. That's fine. That'll save us some time and trouble with the court system, and he'll still have paid his punishment and paid the policeman. Landis and Posner, Judge Posner and Bill Landis, who was his longtime co-author, University of Chicago Law School, wrote a response to this article in which they first made various detailed criticisms, at least one of which I think I later showed was wrong. But they also pointed out that one of the things that Becker and Stigler had not thought about was who owned the right to catch a criminal. If you think about it, it's sort of like hunting or fishing without any property rights. Are different cops going to be competing to find the evidence and get in the fine and so forth? And they suggested that a simple and obvious solution to that is to say that the right initially belongs to the victim of the crime. He can then transfer it to any private cop of his choice, sell it, give it away, whatever, which seemed like a sort of a neat, elegant way of doing things. At which point they pointed out that Becker and Stigler had just reinvented tort law. Because the way tort law works is that if I am damaged, you dent my car, I have a right to collect damages from you. I'm probably not a lawyer and not a private detective or anything, so if investigation and prosecution has to be done, I, in effect, turn my right over to them, hire them to do it, and they do it. So that was sort of a neat bit which I read and was interesting in. I was at Tulane, I think, at the time this happened, if I remember correctly, as an economics professor in the business school. And so I wrote two articles. One of them was a technical article, and if any of you are really economist types, the article's up on my webpage. I'm still proud of it because I think I showed a clever way of slightly modifying the system that Landis and Posner had proposed in a way that automatically solved a problem that they were claiming was impossible to solve. But the second article I wrote came from the fact that I thought I knew about a historical society that had done more or less what Stigler and Becker had proposed, namely Saga period Iceland, because that was a system where, in effect, criminal law was treated as tort law, where when you killed somebody, his relatives acquired a case against you. They could settle that case for a money payment. They could push the case through the court and get money damages and further out punishment to you, and so forth. So I wrote that up as an article, and these were, I think, both published in Journal of Legal Studies, which came out of Chicago, and I think Landis may have been the editor. And so Landis and Posner invited me to come visit Chicago to argue with them at shorter range, and I ended up spending about 10 years as a faculty fellow in the law school in Chicago before I came out here to spend 20-some years as a law professor at SCU. So, as I say, it played a noticeable role in my history, but also in my intellectual life, because one of my conclusions was, isn't this neat stuff? Isn't this fascinating, seeing how a quite different legal system worked, how they solved various problems or didn't solve various problems, and so forth. All right, so that's the background. Now let me discuss. Yes? Oh, right. Yeah?
First of all,
sure.
Thank you.
No.
Are bounty hunters a manifestation of that kind of private law?
Yes, that is... $100 dead and alive is the old Western version. Now, it depends. There are lots of intermediate systems. We'll later get into 18th century England, where enforcement of criminal law was public, but prosecution was private, and where you had thief takers who were, in effect, professional bounty hunters, as it were. One very famous one ends up as the villain in Threepenny Opera, in Die Groschenoper, for those of you who happen to know that piece of literature. Jonathan Wild, thief-taker extraordinary to the United Kingdom by his self-appointment, who for about 10 years profitably combined the profession of thief-taker, large-scale employer of thieves, until they caught him and hanged him. Anyway, that's another story we may get into later. Yeah?
I know this is jumping your presentation,
yep.
But... I was interested in your phrase, incentive compatible.
Yes.
Now, I think that, I'll give you an example. When you, in Romania, if you're riding the public transit,
mm-hmm.
You're supposed to have a ticket ahead of time.
Yeah.
They have people undercover who go and check to see whether you have a ticket.
Yeah.
Okay, one of your options is to pay the ticket, but the other is to pay the
right.
checker.
Right.
And that is done all the time. And
right.
I bet that that's just a small example of
sure.
a much larger picture of how criminal law enforcement is incentive compatible.
Well, yes and no. That is... you can either see that as the corruption of the way it's supposed to it is working, or as Becker and Stigler's plan, de facto the not de jure. Yeah?
What I'm concerned about is why this argument, it seems like economic considerations override anything else.
No. You could imagine a policeman who turned down the bribe because he was an honest man, but the fact that you set it up so that it is not in his interest to do so makes him less likely to do so than if you could set it up so it was in his interest. Right? Yeah.
Well, the problem I have with Beckler and Stigler is the idea that one of the savings of their idea was that you had saving the cost of a trial. And I thought, well, you can have evidence, there's evidence, but without a trial, you could throw any kind of evidence at somebody and extort money out of them.
Well, only if he believes that you have the... In their version, you've got... Either you have to settle out of court, yes, in tort, but your threat is the threat to try him. So if you don't have evidence that's convincing, you don't have a very effective threat against him either. So the history of Iceland. Iceland was discovered by the Norse about 870 AD. There's some evidence that there may have been some Irish monks living there earlier who promptly decamped when they saw the Norse coming or something, but the history as we have it really starts then. Around that time, a little after that, Harald Haarfagr was unifying Norway under his rule. Norway had been a patchwork of small kingdoms with relatively weak kings. And Harald not only put it together into one kingdom, he also claimed a good deal more authority than his predecessors had. And I could talk about more at greater length, but we only have 2 hours. However, the chief professions of the Norwegians at the time were farming and piracy. Lots of them were Vikings, and so the ones who didn't like it loaded up their longboats with their family, their retainers, as many of their beasts would fit in, and went off to Iceland. Some of them went other places. Some of them settled in Ireland and in the islands, but a lot of them went to Iceland, and that's how Iceland got settled. I like to say that the beginning of every country's history is the strong king who is responsible for it. Well, in the case of Iceland, the strong king responsible for it was Harald, because everybody left. Not everybody left, but enough left to settle Iceland. They set up a legal system which was based on the Norwegian system, the system which worked out about 930 AD. However, they decided that there was one element of the Norwegian legal system they could live without, and that was the king. And so they set up a legal system where there was no executive arm of government. There was a court system and there was a legislature, but there was no legislative, no executive arm to enforce court decisions or do anything else. That system was set up in 930. The first big conflict is the Christian-pagan dispute in the year 1000. I'll come back to that a little bit later, but that got settled mostly peacefully. There was then increasing internal conflict starting about 1200 AD, what's referred to as the Sturlung period because of one family that was particularly influential, often fighting itself during that period. And then in 1262, three of the four quarters voted to turn over the country to the King of Norway, and in 1263, the North Quarter agreed, and that was the end of the Icelandic Commonwealth. But it had lasted for about a third of a millennium, so considerably longer than our system has lasted, and it produced quite a lot of first-rate literature, as I think I may or may not have commented to you. We're talking about a population of 70,000 people, most of 1,000 years ago, in a far corner of the world. There are probably more than a dozen of the books they wrote currently in print in English paperbacks. All right, imagine that for something much smaller than Santa Clara. So anyway, it's an interesting system, interesting society. The sources for information. One of the advantages of Iceland over many of these is we actually have noticeable amount of information on it, how it worked. And the first source, and the one I was initially relying on when I did my article, were the family sagas. And the family sagas are basically histories and historical novels. They are set mostly in the 10th and the 11th century. They were written down in the 13th and 14th centuries. It is a long-standing scholarly dispute as to whether they were composed in the 13th and 14th centuries based on sort of vague historical stuff like a modern historical novel, or whether they were composed as an oral literature at about the time the events happened, passed down as oral literature, and then finally written down. Now, one thing is they're prose, not verse. There are poems in them that people speak, but the body of a saga is prose, and that makes it harder to transmit something in oral, because verse is one way of preserving things. There's a fascinating article by Jesse Byock, who's probably maybe the leading American scholar of this stuff, that was in Scientific American, of all places, in which he points out that in one of the sagas, Egil's saga, you have three men, father, son, and grandson, all of whom have the same odd set of physical traits, roughly. And in the case of the grandson, Egil himself, we actually know what his skull looked like because there was the cemetery was moved at some point after his death. He was a famous man. People were curious, so they dug him up, looked at his skull, and described it. And it turned out that all of this information fits a hereditary disease known as Paget's syndrome, which was not discovered until the 19th century. So Byock's argument was it is unlikely that all of these apparently unrelated facts would have stayed together in sort of what people remembered about him several hundred years later. So that's some evidence that at least a good deal of the story was put together when people were still remembering these things. Whether he's right, we don't know, but it's a neat argument. In general, the sagas are very unlike what I think of as medieval literature. If you read the Chanson de Roland, I'm not sure how many hundred Saracens Roland kills, and he only dies when he bursts a blood vessel blowing his horn to try to get Charlemagne to come back. I think Egil boasts of once having fought 10 men and survived. And that's sort of the scale. And he is, you know, clearly a very formidable person. And similarly with some other, there are some other cases in the sagas. So the violence tends to be quite small scale. When there is a clash, they name everybody who's been killed or wounded, and so forth. Neat stuff. Quite fun to read. If people want to read stuff, I'll be glad to give recommendations. Sturlung sagas were accounts of events during the period of breakdown, mostly the 13th century, some stuff a little bit earlier, and they are written largely by participants. And one of the reasons this matters is that we have more reason to believe that the people who wrote the Sturlung sagas actually knew what was happening at the time they were writing about than we do for the family sagas, because one possible explanation of some inconsistencies in our sources of evidence is that maybe the authors of the family sagas got it wrong. Right? Because then we have a third source, and that's what's called Gragas, the Grey Goose book, due to a mistake. That's the label, due to a mistake, apparently. And it is a very extensive account of the law. The English translation is 2 volumes, done by people in Canada. It hadn't been done when I wrote my original article, so I was dependent on the sagas and the secondary literature, but when I wrote the chapter in this book about it, it had been, and I'd read it. And it's not official statutes. It's based basically on 2 extensive private accounts of what the law was, plus a few other fragments. One of them is from the very end of the period, 1260, and the other is from just after the end of the period. They are sometimes consistent with each other and sometimes not, and they are, on some important issues, inconsistent with the sagas. And if you're curious, you can read the chapter in the book where I discuss what the inconsistencies are and what are plausible explanations of them. So I'm not going to do that here because it takes too long. All right, the system that's described in the Gragas and shown in working in the sagas. The central figure is the Godi. Godi is generally mistranslated as chieftain. It's mistranslated because there is no tribe involved. What a Godi is somebody who owns a bundle of property rights which let other people interface with the legal system through him. Being a Godi, the right to be a Godi is called a gudord, and the right to be a Godi is private property. You can leave it to your son, you can sell it to someone else, you and your brother can share it, taking turns on who exercises the powers. Everybody else, well, all other farmers, really, there are also sort of servants within the farm household, but every, as they would say, thing tax paying farmer is the thingman of a Godi. It does not have to be, the Godi does not own the farmer's land. The farmer is free to switch to another Godi who will have him. I think there's some question as to whether it has to be in the same quarter of Iceland or not. And the only obligation the thingman really has is to contribute to the expenses of those thingmen who go with the Godi to the annual assembly at the Althing, which is where the higher level courts happen, as well as lots of other stuff. But that's the so-called thing tax. But other than that, it really is more nearly the relationship between a client and a lawyer, as it were, than between a feudal lord and his. So I think of it as franchise feudalism, in the sense there were a fixed number of these. Initially, I think 36, and it goes up to 40 or so later on. I think that's right. And the legislature consists of the Godar, that's plural of Godi, 2 advisors for each, and after Iceland went Christian, 2 bishops. The higher level courts have 36 judges. They call them judges, but it's more like a jury because it's by a vote of a large group of people. And we think what happened was that in a relatively high-level case, high-level, basically if you had a dispute with somebody whose gothi was in the same group of three gothord, which was sort of territorial, as yours, you could take it to the local court. And then, but it could then get pushed up. But the sort of important courts that we see most of the action in the sagas of are the courts at the Althing. And for those courts, you have 36 judges, and we think that each gothi in Iceland got to appoint one judge for each case. So very dispersed, so therefore most of the judges would be more or less neutral. Now, I'm oversimplifying a little bit because the North Quarter, for some reason, was sort of a special case, and everybody else got 9 gothar. The North Quarter got 12, but each of them had sort of 3/4 of the right, so they appointed the same number of judges as the other quarters, but I'm not going into that. All right? There was a legislature, a court system, and no executive arm to enforce verdicts. That was up to the prevailing plaintiff and his friends. How does enforcement work? What stabilizes the system? Someone does something illegal, you sue in the court system, win, and are awarded damages. He pays or he doesn't pay. If he doesn't pay, you go back to the court system, which outlaws him. It is legal to kill an outlaw, and it is tortious to defend or shelter an outlaw. So if he and his friends try to fight with you and your friends, every time somebody on your side is injured, that's the basis for a new case. And unless they pay, that pulls all of the relatives of the injured party into your coalition because they want to collect the money they're now owed. One example of the stability of what seems at first like an unstable system out of Njalsaga, which is one of the more famous of the sagas, is there's a conflict which has gotten serious enough so it looks as though it's going to break out into fighting in what's in effect an open-air courtroom at the Althing. And a leader of one side goes to a guy who's sort of a benevolent neutral, and he says, if we end up fighting, then what will you do to help us? And his answer is, I'll draw up my men armed over there, and if you're losing, you can retreat between them, and that'll end the fight. And if you're winning, we'll break up the fight before you kill more men than you can afford. So the assumption is that even if it breaks down this badly, eventually when the dust clears, if you kill people, you're going to have to pay for them. Sturlungasaga. This is later when things are going much worse. But there is a sort of a, to me, revealing bit where one faction has attacked another to get somebody and ended up setting the house on fire and killing some people. And then there's eventually a settlement. And in the settlement, they agree to pay wergeld for the men they killed when they burned the house. However, not for that guy, because we offered to let him out, and he refused. In fact, we offered to pay him to come out, and he refused. So we don't owe money for killing him. And again, I think both of those are suggesting that the system was more stable than it might at first seem. That even by the late Stirling period, it's looking like a civil war. You've got sort of factions. You've finally got fights with maybe 100 people on a side instead of 4 people on a side. But even then, the factions keep shifting. And if you kill people and don't pay wergeld, that's sort of guaranteeing that next round their kin will be on the other side from you, whereas if you want to be able to make terms with them, you want to pay wergeld. So I think what you... Yes?
So the question of wergeld, do you happen to know if that was real money or things like pelts?
It was defined in silver. It was, I think, 200 ounces of silver, if I remember correctly. The other main monetary thing was vafmal, which was wool cloth. And there was, I think, an official exchange rate between them, so payments might be in either.
It goes to the very top here. Yeah. It says if he doesn't pay you, then the court outlaws him.
Yeah.
What does it mean to outlaw?
They declare that he's an outlaw. That changes his legal status, and that changes how other cases will go. Right? It means that if you kill him and his relatives sue you, they'll lose because you killed an outlaw. Unless you hit his body, which is a special case. And
okay, so that leads to the next topic heading, means that you get self-enforcement. People,
that's right.
Individuals can kill.
Absolutely. Yep. Sure.
Yeah. Being an outlaw is really a capital punishment.
Yeah, it's a little complicated. There's a lesser outlawry in which you're outlawed for a limited time and basically are allowed to leave Iceland and then come back in 3 years and you're a safe man then. And there's the greater outlawry, which does not have that provision. But also, if you actually look at the sagas, people who are willing to pay weregeld normally don't get outlawed. That if you believe Gragas, if you kill somebody and don't have a legitimate excuse, even if you're willing to pay damages, you get outlawed. But if you look at the sagas, almost all cases are settled out of court, with the threat of the court case there. And it seems very common that the settlement is, all right, you killed two of our people, you owe us a certain amount of money, we killed one of your people, we owe you half of it back, pay the money, and it's done. There's a famous sequence in Njal's saga where you've got two men who are good friends and their wives are not good friends, and the wives are provoking members of the household to kill back and forth in revenge, and the men are passing a purse of silver back and forth. quite a weird scene, yes.
So what if you didn't have the resources to pay the
Well, I guess you got outlawed. Or that, not necessarily. You have the option. They have a form of sort of temporary slavery. Debt thraldom is an option. And, of course, you may have friends and relatives who will pay and expect to be repaid. Yeah?
Is this similar to the Middle Eastern idea of blood money?
Well, we got into that, I thought, on the first day when I discussed Islamic law, where diya, which is the Arabic equivalent of weregeld, under current law, that's current, under standard religious Islamic law, which nobody really follows, although Saudis are closer than anybody else, I think. If you kill somebody deliberately, first-degree murder, as it were, his kin have a choice of either retaliating and killing you or accepting diya. If you kill somebody under less, obviously, criminal circumstances, you still owe a lesser diya, but they don't have the alternative of killing you. But yeah.
Forgive me if this is where you're going, but it seems like this would incentivize power to the rich or powerful.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. There are lots of them, though. And as long as there are, let's keep going and see if I answer your question adequately. What about the weak?
Yeah.
Oh. Tort claims are transferable. So I'm an old man with one son and somebody kills him. Legally speaking, I can prosecute, collect weregeld, maybe get somebody outlawed, but I'll be beaten up on my way to court. All right. My neighbor has four strong sons who went a Viking in their youth, lots of relatives and allies, so I transfer my claim to him. He goes to court, wins the case, collects the weregeld. Maybe he shares it with me, maybe not. That's going to depend on the terms between us. But the critical thing is that my son's killing has been avenged, which is a reason not to violate the rights even of the weak. All right, that's one of the interesting features of that system. My claim is valuable. The fact that that if the case is competently prosecuted, the people who've got the resources to do it, it'll win. It's worth enforcing to collect money damages. Also, the guy who killed my son may have enemies who would like a good excuse for getting him. And you have cases like that in the sagas. And there may be people who want to get reputation, who want to say, look, there's that big tough fellow who killed the son of this poor innocent old man, and I'm enough of a man to put him down. And you can see that sort of stuff happening in there are cases of sort of volunteer prosecutors, as it were, in the sagas. And you also get that pattern, incidentally, among the Comanche Indians, who I'm not covering in this course, but if you look in the book, I've got a chapter on the Plains Indians, which includes that. Next question is, why do you enforce? There are a number of reasons why you choose, because, of course, enforcing can be risky. The guy you're trying to kill might kill you, after all. Winning a case and then enforcing the verdict may be costly. One reason, obviously, is money damages, as in our tort system. Another is deterrence. I and my friends and relatives want it to be clear that if you wrong one of us, whether killing or something else, something bad will happen to them. We'll prosecute or insist on an out-of-court settlement. One feature of the system is that who had committed the offense was usually not an issue. As is often the case, usually the case in tort law as well, that the argument is, was it an offense and what's owed? If you killed somebody under the legal system, you are, if I remember the language correctly, this may be from a Norwegian code rather than the Icelandic, you are not to pass three houses without stopping at one of them to say who you are, who you killed, where he's lying, and what wounds you claim to have made. Except if all three houses have relatives of the guy you killed, and you can then go on to a fourth house. But the basic idea is that both killing and taking are supposed to be open, not secret. If you didn't do that, what you had committed was not killing, but murder. Just killing somebody announcing it is not murder, although it still results in your having to pay Wehrgeld and likely getting outlawed or settling. And murder was shameful. And not only was it shameful, it had legal consequences, because by concealing the fact of the killing, you gave up your possible defenses. In particular, killing an outlaw is not illegal, but killing an outlaw and hiding his body is. There, at least if you believe Gragas, there are circumstances in which somebody has forfeited his immunity, has done something, for example, attacked you. In fact, if you believe Gragas, their definition of self-defense was considerably broader than ours. It looks as though if somebody attacks you, you're not only entitled to fight back, you're entitled to kill him 3 days later. Basically, until the time when the case can get to court, he will fall with forfeit immunity, assuming you later prove that he had attacked you. And I believe that members of the people who were with you when he attacked you could kill him on that day, but not thereafter. Again, I'm not sure how much this is true, because I don't know how much I trust Gragas, but at least it looks as though you've got various circumstances in which killing is excused, and you lose those defenses if you aren't open about it. Similarly for theft, which is bad as opposed to robbery, which is what all good Vikings do. And let me tell you one of my stories, and this is the story about Egil Skallagrimsson, in fact. Egil and some of his companions went raiding on the Baltic coast, probably the south coast of the Baltic, and something went wrong. They got captured. The people they were raiding threw nets over them, trapped them against a hedge, and took them prisoner. They're tied up and put in a locked up in a building while the villagers go off to celebrate their victory. Egil is a very strong man, and he breaks his bonds, and he frees the rest. And they then discover that in a pit in the same room, there is another Norseman who was captured a year before and who they're planning to kill shortly, but who knows his way around. And he tells them that the building they're in has strong walls. It's going to be hard to break out. But the inside wall connects this room to the room where the villagers have their weapons and treasury. And so Egil breaks through the wall. They arm themselves, pick up a chest of silver, and head back for the ship. And they get about halfway there, and Egil says, "Wait a minute, what are we doing? We're stealing these people's money." "Egil, come on." Egil puts down the chest of silver, turns around, and walks back to the village. And the villagers are feasting, celebrating their victory in their feast hall. And outside, there's a fire with logs coming in like a star burning at the center. Egil, who is a strong man, picks up the logs one by one, stuffs them under the thatch edges of the thatch roof all the way around the feast hall. And once the roof has caught flame, he goes to the only door and he comes in and he says, "I'm Egil Skallagrimsson. I took your silver. What do you want to do about it?" And kills anybody who tries to come out. Now, having behaved in an honorable fashion, he goes back, picks up the chest of silver, and goes back to the ship. That's from Egil's saga. Egil's saga is quite interesting. There are some other neat things in it, too. But I don't want to spend all day telling saga stories, though one could. All right. What happened to the system? First big test is in 1000. Norway goes Christian and is trying to pressure Iceland, too. They're seizing Icelandic ships in Norwegian ports and only letting the people go if they'll convert. A number of Icelanders, for that reason or for better reasons, do convert, come back to Iceland. There's conflict between the pagan Icelanders and the Christian Icelanders, and several people are killed. Both sides come to the Althing sort of ready to fight, and they declare themselves out of law with each other, which I think means we now have two countries that happen to be sitting on the same island. In interacting with other members of our half of it, we will do it by the law. The other half, you're foreigners. Cooler heads prevail, and they decide to agree on arbitration. The arbitration is by the law speaker, who is a pagan. He's the one official in the system, who has a 3-year term. And the conclusion is that Iceland is going to be Christian, with private pagan worship permitted, but not public pagan worship. I suspect they gave up, that they probably abandoned those terms later on as Christianity got stronger, but that was at least the original settlement. Sturlung period. power is becoming more concentrated, where you will have multiple gavurot held by members of the same family. So it's becoming a less competitive system than it had been before. I don't entirely know why. There are various possible conjectures, but it's clear that that was happening. You're getting larger scale violence, and whereas the traditional violence was really about, you have wronged me, I want compensation, this is beginning to look more and more like a civil war about who's going to end up as, in effect, king of Iceland when the dust clears. Eventually, that got bad enough so that instead of any of the people becoming ruler of Iceland, they voted to turn over rule over Iceland to the king of Norway. Why? We don't know. One possibility is it's the corrupting effect of foreign ideology, that the Icelanders start out with a fairly strong view of their own way of doing things, but perhaps over time and with more interaction, they started thinking more in terms of everybody else has a king, we'll eventually have a king. I want to make sure it's me or my friend, not you or your friend. Maybe. Norway had been in a period of a lot of internal conflict. By the 13th century, that's over. The Norwegian monarchy is relatively rich and powerful, and they are continually meddling in Icelandic politics. So if you're a leading figure in this civil war and your side loses for a while and you're outlawed, you go off to Norway, you make yourself a man of the king of Norway, join his retainers, he gives you money and support, and you go back and supposedly make him ruler of Iceland, but what you really do is to try to make yourself ruler of Iceland. And then this repeats, and maybe the king of Norway is making a mistake, or maybe he realizes that if you stir the pot long enough, he's going to end up in control, as he in fact did. All right. Another possibility is the Christianity is at fault. Because in the traditional system, as I say, the only tax was the thing tax, and that was just for expenses of members of your gathord who went to the all thing. But with Christianity, a landowner donates the land for building a church. He then, in some sense, owns that church, appoints the priest. There are tithes paid to the church. They are supposed to, they're divided, I think, in four portions, used in various ways, but it looks like a situation where the landowner in question could probably get his hands on some of it, and that might give you a tax base that would fund, as it were, your expansion. But I think we really don't know. It's an interesting puzzle, but it is pretty clear that there is a tendency to concentration of wealth and power over that third of a millennium, and that results in destabilizing the system. Particularly interesting for those of us who like the idea of stateless systems, because part of the question is under what circumstances do they break down and how. How well did it work? Well, the sagas certainly describe a lot of conflict, but if you actually look at it until the Sterling period, it's very small scale conflict. You're talking about, you know, half a dozen people on each side, some may, often fewer than that. Four people fight five people, and one guy is killed on one side, and two people are injured on the other. That kind of scale of stuff in the sagas. Furthermore, the sagas naturally telescope the action. They leave out the boring bits where nobody's fighting or suing anybody. One of the English historians who wrote about this has some comment about, to the effect that it's amazing that you had such an elaborate legal system and rich literature among a society where the main activity of people was killing each other. And my response to that is he's got it wrong. The main activity of Icelanders was suing each other, and they just needed an occasional killing to keep the lawsuits going. But even that is an exaggeration. That's just what gives you. It's like the Wild West, right? I mean, the Wild West, the number of people actually killed in Dodge City was pretty small. I think that if you actually look at the numbers, but that's what makes the stories. Anyway, one historian went through the Sturlung sagas counting bodies. And I'm not sure how reliable the result is, but at least his calculation was that over 52 years, about 350 people were killed. Population about 70,000, so it's about 7 people a year on average, so about one death in 10,000. That's roughly what the U.S. murder rate was at its peak 20 years ago, and that's roughly what the current highway death rate is. So, and that's the period of breakdown. That's when things are going badly enough so they eventually give up. We don't have very many experiments in these things, but we do have a single sample experiment, because Iceland faced religious conflict twice. In 1000 AD, the question was pagan versus Christian. About 6 people were killed. in about 1550, by which time the Danes, rather than the Norwegians, ruled Iceland. The king of Denmark insisted on their changing from Catholic to Lutheran, and about 60 people were killed in that conflict out of what was then a smaller population, because you had had the little ice age happening, with the result was that that part of the world was producing less food than it had been. Yeah.
Which ones were killed, the Lutherans or the Catholics?
Both. That's the Lutherans won, but people on both sides were killed, just as in the Christian pagan case. I mean... All right, so that's Iceland. Let me stop just for a minute to see if you have questions before I go on to the Somali, who are also quite a lot of fun. Yes?
The laws in the 12th century, what was it? The saga, the family sagas, and the sagas of the Gragas?
Gragas is, yes.
The Gragas, I had the impression the Gragas were more severe than the laws you could infer from the sagas. And I was wondering if that might have something to do with, like, what you saw, was it in Islamic law, where sometimes you have all these capital punishments, and yet they were never really enforced.
Yeah.
Is it intended to scare people?
Yeah. Jesse Byock, well, except that these are not... Well, Jesse Byock's comment was that he thought Gragas was a rich boy's wish list. that it was not what was actually getting enforced. But the question of explaining Gragas versus the sagas is an interesting and complicated question. But because on the one hand, the business of falling with forfeit immunity, in the sagas that doesn't seem to be happening. That you have a case in Njalssaga where Gunnar and his brother are attacked by a number of enemies and kill several of them, and the enemies are running away. And Kolske, Gunnar's brother, says, let's go after them and you'll kill some more. And Gunnar says, our purses will be empty enough when this is over already. So the implication is that even though they were the attackers, and even though if you read Gragas, you've got a perfect right to chase him down and kill him, he doesn't think that's going to happen. Yeah. Yes?
I was fascinated by the fact that the emphasis is on killing other men.
The only women who are killed, as far as I can remember, are witches, and that's very rare.
It says, well, also, in the rare case where an attacker burns the defender's home, women, children, and servants are first offered the opportunity to live.
Yeah.
Rape and torture are uncommon. The killing of women almost unheard of.
Yeah.
So that, wow.
That's interesting. Yeah, no. As I say, the only exception are there are some cases where you've got sorceresses, witches essentially, and in the sagas who get killed, and those are the only ones, I think. But I'm trying to remember the details, but I think there's a scene where I think a woman's brother has been killed, and I think it's that her husband has taken a bribe to betray him, and the woman strikes her husband with the bag of silver, if I remember correctly, and nothing happens to her.
Was a woman as expensive as a man?
That's an interesting question, and the answer is I don't know, because I don't remember seeing any references to Wergeld for killing a woman. All right. Anyway, yes.
Step back a bit and look at your whole picture that you know better than we do. Do you think there's anything about the Icelandic system that is related to the small death rate, considering?
I don't know, but the way I like to put it is that England, Norway, and Normandy probably lost a larger fraction of their population to violence in 3 weeks of the year 1066 than Iceland did in 50 years of civil war. We don't really have body counts for those, but that's...
But you don't see a connection to the Icelandic legal system?
I don't know. I'm just reporting the facts, so far as we know them, not as well as we'd like to. Yeah.
Is there a deterrence factor in declaring this? I mean, we're dealing with illiterate societies where written law doesn't get in here.
That is, you get. I think you eventually get a written version. Initially, the job of the law speaker was to memorize the law. And he was supposed to recite a third of it each year of his 3-year term at the Althing. But I think some point, I'm trying to remember, maybe in the 11th or 12th century, you finally get written texts.
But what you're describing is really fairly straightforward. Mm-hmm. You do this happens.
Well, except if you act, as I say, Gragas itself is two fairly substantial volumes. So there's a lot of detailed stuff. And there has to be. If you sort of actually get into law, it's always more complicated than you would think it was. All right, let me look at Somali law as my next case. The history, the North, after World War II, Northern Somalia is a British protectorate, Southern Somalia an Italian protectorate. In Somaliland, it looks to me as though mostly they were running their own affairs, although the British intervened some and had been even well before that. England and Italy pull out in 1960, and what they set up is a modern centralized democracy for a place that had no history of anything similar to that. It lasted for 9 years. Siad Barre pulls a military coup, gets into a war with Ethiopia, supported by the USSR. The USSR switches sides to support Ethiopia. For what reasons, I don't know. The war goes badly. Barre is assassinated, and things look as though they're going back to their past situation. But the US and the UN decide that Somalia needs to be one country with a government and attempt to establish one. And we don't really have a whole lot of troops in that part of Africa, but that's all right. We use the Ethiopian army to do it. And that was not a popular decision. Meanwhile, in the north, the Somalis created the Republic of Somaliland, which we in the UN refused to recognize because that would be admitting that Somalia isn't a country, which, as it happens, is true. And there continues to be violence around Mogadishu in the south, presumably because the Somalis have figured out that if there's going to be a government, they want to be it. That is, many different Somalis figured out that it matters who controls the government. So let me go back then to the traditional system, which is what I'm interested in. That bit was just to explain that you shouldn't blame the Somalis for it. You should blame us. I should say my main source for this was a man by the name of Lewis, who unfortunately is no longer alive, who was a London School of Economics anthropologist who had been studying Somalia since, I think, the 1950s. And I'm to some extent mirroring his attitude on what actually ended up happening there. So traditional system, and one of the neat bits about it is that you have a formal, explicit structure of nested coalitions, and these coalitions are based partly on agnatic kinship in the male line, so that the smallest of these clusters would typically be the descendants in the male line of a common grandfather. Then several such groups, possibly because they've got a common great-grandfather, but not always, make up the next one up, and so forth, all the way up till you get to a clan of hundreds of thousands of people. And each of these groups is partly based on kinship, but also on explicit contract. In the simplest case, it's defined by the genealogy tree. Every Somali knows his ancestry for many generations up. If you have a Somali cab driver, which you will sometimes have in San Jose, if you ask him his ancestry, he can probably tell you at least 10 generations up, maybe more than that. As one of the quotes I came across, what a person's address is in Europe, his genealogy is in Somaliland. It places him socially. And the closer two people's agnatic kinship, the more likely they are to be allies in a conflict. Not guaranteed, but more likely. They use the term a pile of shields for a group that does not have kingship at its basis. If you say, all right, I don't have enough kin to make a group adequate to protect us and deal with things, so let's get together with a bunch of other people in that situation and we'll create our own group, that's a pile of shields, and that's what the Somali used to refer to the British Commonwealth and to the U.S. alliance against the Soviets, because here we had a coalition not based on kinship. You might argue the Commonwealth is, but not if you consider all of the places that are not populated by Englishmen. So they had, in fact, an explicit social contract, sometimes in writing. I give in the book one example that I got from my source of such a contract. Within a dia-paying group, which is the level of this which is mostly doing, well, it's complicated. You've got a dia-paying group, and it's made up of what he calls jifo-paying groups, which are sort of subgroups of that. But within a dia-paying group, the contract specifies if we have to pay Dia, which is their version. Dia is actually the Arabic version of Wehrgeld. I think what's going on is that the English anthropologists who studied Somalia had previously studied the Bedouin, because apparently Dia is not actually the word in the Somali language, but that's what they all use, so I've been using it as well. And I tend to go back and forth between that and Wehrgeld, which is the version I first encountered, but they're all the same basic idea. So within a Dea-paying group, if one of our members kills somebody and there's a settlement and we owe a certain number of camels as payment, the contract says, all right, every member, a third of it maybe, is to be paid, spread among the general membership of our group. A second third among the members of the subgroup that the person who did the killing is part of, and the last third he pays. I'm making that up. You can look at the particular contract, but they would specify those sorts of terms. And similarly, if we collect dia, because one of our people was killed or injured, how you divide up by group and subgroup the dia collecting.
Does the dia only apply to the pile of shields?
No.
That's all groups.
I kill somebody, we end up settling it, I owe his kid money. But I am a member of a group inside a group inside a group, and a group at one of these levels has a contract saying, all right, we will share part of the amount you owe, and your subgroup, your part in, will share another part, and then you'll pay a part of it. So that these groups exist in part to solve the problem of how do you pay the money, as it were. And I mentioned, I think, briefly when I was talking about the Islamic one, the Aqila, which is the Bedouin and then Islamic equivalent of this system, which according to my students at SCU a few years ago, who were Saudis, if one of them was in an auto accident and killed somebody, their Aqila would pay part of the damage payment they would then owe. Very similar system. And of course, Somalia is not that far from Arabia, if you look at a map, and the Somalis are almost all Muslims. And in fact, the Somali clans generally claim descent from some prominent figure in early Islamic history, different one for different clans, although this may well be a fiction, we don't know. Yeah.
So like with the Iceland, this is a kind of an insurance system.
Well, sort of, yeah. It's partly an insurance system, but it's also partly a alliance to enforce rights system, because if you're the victim, the other members of your group are going to help you collect. Right. All right. The law. Special laws are established within a group by contract. General laws apply at least to all members of a clan, may or may not be the same across clans. Laws are interpreted by a judge, and the judge is not a profession. He doesn't have an official position. He is somebody who is accepted by the disputants as an arbitrator, and he's working on customary practice. So if judges make repeated decision in some direction, it becomes more likely another judge will make that decision later. And I've got this nice quote from one of my sources: a Somali judge is free to develop his own principles of law and his own doctrines. The test of whether such principles and doctrines are acceptable to the community comes as soon as he has given his verdict on a conflict. If a verdict deviates from what the community finds reasonable and just, there is little chance that its author will be asked again to sit as a judge. Yeah.
When it says general laws are broad principles applying to all members of the clan, where do women come in all of this? Are they considered members of the clan?
Yes.
And how are the laws applied
to them? Certainly the laws would apply to them. Whoopsie. What in the world? Why in the world is it asking? I don't want to. I'm not sure. First, I have to figure out how to get onto that screen.
It must be time for the break.
almost. But what is going on here? I do not know. Let me see. Does this? That mouse doesn't do anything.
Is there a Mac equivalent of Escape?
I can certainly end the show, and let me see if I can then, can I get onto the other screen? And it's not letting me go onto the other screen, so if I could enter on either machine, will that treat it as continue?
It might go away if you hit continue.
I can't reach continue because of my mouse is on my screen, not on that screen. And so far, I don't want to ask you anything. Thank you.
Are we showing the wrong screen, not your
computer? No. My presentation mode on PowerPoint has this nice feature that I see a screen which also shows me the next slide. Mm. So I'm seeing that on my machine while you're seeing this on this machine. Does that make sense? If I understood this system better, I would be able to do that.
They're complicated.
Just a minute. I can turn... Yeah, I think it better be break time until I can figure this out. Yes. Let's see, just a minute. This may do it. This may do it or may not. Let's see.
Well, it just changed.
I just did. Aha. Yeah, except that now you're getting my screen, which is not what you want to have, but let's see if we can manage this. Just a minute. Here is this. Now let me again go to presentation mode, presenter view, and see if we're back. Yes. We're back in business. Awesome. Very good. All right, so we've got a few more minutes before you. So special laws established by contract within a group. General laws are, this is basically a traditional system where people sort of think they know about what the rules are. And there's my quote about a Somali judge. Right. Penalties. If somebody is killed, that sets off blood feud, and either the killer is killed or the kin of the victim accept dia, where guilt. Yeah.
Is there a difference between accidental killing and deliberate killing?
I don't know. In some of these systems, that in the Islamic there is, and I do not know whether there is in Somalia or not. You have to realize I can't possibly know enough to really be an expert on all these legal systems. So some questions I can answer and some I can't. I think if you look at the book, I do cite Lewis's books, and if you can find them, they would give you a much more detailed account than I have. If the killer gets away, however, another member of his kin can be killed instead. So his kin, talk about incentive compatibility, his kin have an incentive not to let the guy who's killed somebody run from the hills. And if killer and victim are of different clans, two for one. That is, if he gets away. Compensation for accidental damage, it's our tort rule that you just have to make him good. You have to pay the amount. For theft, two for one compensation. Also, the Jewish law as it happens. That's Islamic Jew. Elements that stabilize the system. If the opposing group is too strong, you move up the hierarchy. All right, I've got a group, and it's only got 50 people in it, and we've discovered that the guy I've got a conflict with is part of a group with 400 people in it, so I basically call in all of the people, all of the other groups my size that were part of the next group up, and we shift the controversy to that level. All right. The dia-paying group is typically 300 to 3,000 males. It's limited at the bottom that there have to be enough to share damages and to enforce claims. And it's limited at the top by the fact that as it gets bigger, you've got more people who want to be leader, who want things done their way. You have more quarrels that my subgroup is being cheated by your subgroup, and so forth and so on. Group has an incentive to control its members. If somebody goes around getting into fights and killing people, then his members have to pay for it, so we don't let him carry a gun anymore. That was an example from one of my sources. Kin are obligated to help with defense but not with offense, which again stabilizes things. And there was a sort of a neat case, one case discussed, where there had been conflict, I think, between members of two different clans, so I'm not sure, maybe lower level groups than that. And people thought there was too much violence, so the leadership of the two clans got together and agreed that they would increase the dia. All right, as an economist, that appeals to me. If you don't want killing, make it more expensive, which is what they did. All right. Now it's probably time to take a break.
They still
follow that today?
What?
Do they still follow that today?
Well, that's an interesting question. My impression is that the Republic of Somaliland is in theory a government based largely on clan elders, but my guess is that what's really happening is probably still that system, but I don't know for certain. But that is basically, as a Lewis is no longer alive, and there were presumably a lot of problems during various coups and then the various civil wars involved in that. So I can't tell you for sure, but my guess is that they've probably gone back to more or less
traditional
systems.
North, not the south.
This is the north. Yes, no. Lewis makes it clear that the institutions in the north and the south are noticeably different, and I've only really looked at the north, Somalia.
How far back does this go?
I think the real answer is that we don't know. If you ask the Somalis, as I say, their clans have a probably fictitious genealogy which goes back to the time of Muhammad or very shortly after that. But what's real, how long it really is, we don't know. We basically, I think, only know about sort of local sultans in some port city along the coast who were dealing with trade and such, and not what was happening in general. There's quite an interesting source by an Englishman who was resident in one of the port cities at a point when this is well before World War II, I think this is around 1900-ish, at a point when England had some nominal involvement, and describing the system as he saw it. But I really don't know. I mean, my guess is it probably goes back many hundreds of years, but can't tell you beyond that. But anyway, it's probably time for our break now, and we can then go on to Ireland and then to the general issue of feud law.
What clan, if the person gets away, another member of the clan is to be killed? There was an Aborigine who talked about the laws amongst
in Australia.
Yes. Same idea, which was if a person kills somebody else in one village, kills a person in another village, somebody in the first village, anybody, could be killed, supposedly.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think versions of that are fairly common, but at least fairly often. Voila. Maybe this class will actually have a full record of it. Class of legal experts, a system of customary law. It converted to Christianity in about the 5th century. Over time, it went from a system where the relative authorities were very local to a point where there were provincial kings. Various people claimed the title of High King of Ireland, but it does not look as though anybody ever really held that position in the sense of ruling all of Ireland, and it was conquered by the Normans in the 12th century. That's a very, very brief sketch, and lots of stuff happened after that, but I'm not interested in it. Sources. There are legal texts from about the 8th century which have not survived. We've got pieces of them in 14th and 16th century material, and then the part of the problem is figuring out what in the 14th material is actually from the 8th century, and the argument at the analysis is done on linguistic grounds, on saying that this is in 8th century Irish, not 14th century Irish. There is some risk that the person writing the 14th century stuff knew enough about 8th century Irish to fake it, so to speak, when he was giving what he was claiming was ancient. So we don't know for sure, but that's what we got. The wisdom texts are surviving things. The Irish sagas, the Tainbo Cooley, the cattle raid of Cooley, is probably the most famous one. That's describing a world with provincial kings, not a high king, and various things going on. And that's, I think, mostly a pre-Christian world that they're describing. And then there are observations people made after the Norman conquest, when presumably you had elements of the previous institutions still functioning. And part of what's puzzling is that part of what we see seems to be describing a system of private law like Iceland. Part seems to be describing a system of royal law, what people refer to as curial law because it happens in courts. And that may be because some people have got it wrong. It may be that the system was different at different places or at different times. All of this is sort of prologue to why I'm not very, very sure about what was really happening, but it still looks interesting. Political structure, you have a Tuath is a kingdom with perhaps 3,000 people in it. There seem to have been about 100 Tuaths in Ireland in the early period. the members of the Tuath owed taxes and military services. The king was the leader in war. His role in the legal system is unclear. And in some sources, we seem to have a purely private legal system, and some not. There could be an overking with several kings in allegiance to him. He gave them gifts, received service. And most individuals had rights only within their own Tuath. Hermits and poets seem to have been an exception. There could be treaty agreements between Tuaths giving inhabitants of one some rights against another, and subjection to a common overking might allow you some rights against some rights outside your Tuath. Assume it was a hermit. It was somebody who, you know, went somewhere and lived all by himself, and I don't know if they either got fed by charity or maybe grew something or something, but didn't associate it. Sort of a religious solitary. But I suspect it was probably in some sense an official status within the system. But again, given the limits of what we have, it's hard to know whether what you're seeing is a very stylized picture of it or an accurate description. Kinship structure. Fine is a kin group. The main important one is the Derb Fine. That's an agnatic group of four generations. So again, it's male line descent. One could argue that female line makes more sense since one knows maternity for certain, whereas paternity is always a conjecture. But nonetheless, this is how these systems worked. Male line descendants of a common great-grandfather. Farming land is largely held in common by the Derb Fine with parts of it temporarily allocated to members. There are circumstances in which somebody can get private land if he earns money himself, in effect. And I think then the land he buys, some of it goes to the Derb Fine and some of it is under his free control. The members of the Derb Fine are an alliance for feud, and like the Diapane group you're just dealing with, they're liable for damages owed by a member. The kin collected for the killing of a member. And that was not limited to the Derb Fine. That if you killed somebody, essentially anybody with some kind of a relationship to him, which could include, I think, a foster father or a foster brother, because you have fostering as a custom, was owed some amount based on the amount based on that person's closeness of relationship and that person's honor price, which we'll get. So the Derb Fine is rather like a Diapane group, except it's in theory at least all kinship except for adoption, which seems to be uncommon, but happens, rather than kinship plus contract. There's a larger kin group going presumably the descendants of the great-grandfather, and if a Derb Fine goes extinct, then its land gets reallocated by the next group up. Marriage. Very interesting. There is a wide range of different marriages, depending on the resources each party contributed. So you can have a marriage on husband's property, or a marriage on wife's property, or a marriage on joint property. And the rights within the marriage depend partly on that, and partly on the degree to which the woman got married with the consent of her kin. I suppose a Romany would say, was she bought or stolen? The greater their consent, the weaker her ties to them. So if they agreed, then they don't have a claim to a share of the damages if she is killed or injured, and don't have an obligation if she does something wrong to pay some of it, whereas if she married without their permission, she is still, as it were, a part of their group. That seems to be the case. The husband could have both a wife and a concubine, secondary wife. Woman was under the authority of her father or father and then husband, and had some rights in the legal system, but limited rights in the legal system. Class structure. Noble, nemed, there are a bunch of different categories of nobles. Most of the nemeds are lords, and the status of the lord is defined by the number of clients he has. So if he loses clients, we'll get to clientage in a minute, he might cease to be a lord or cease to be as high a lord as he was. If you acquire clients, it takes three generations for your status to go up to Nemed status. Yep.
I was amazed to read that poets were considered a member of the Nemed. Do
Do you have any insight into the status of poets in Ireland?
They clearly they seem to be fairly high status people, but I don't know beyond that. And I'm not sure, their poets may also be singers. I don't know enough about what Bard really meant there. And there are two sorts of clients, free clients and unfree clients, where the free client can leave his client at any time, but he's going to owe certain things back to the Lord who had originally provided him stuff when he became a client. And the unfree one, after he's a client for a certain length of time, the stuff his Lord has given him becomes his, but he's not as free to pull out. And again, it's more complicated than that, but that's sort of a brief sketch. There is then one other rather odd category of noble, and that's a hospitaller. And that's somebody who basically accepts the obligation to provide hospitality to anybody who shows up. And it is generally assumed that he has to be wealthy to get away with that. So it looks like a way in which somebody who's wealthy and willing to do this can get high status. And then some professionals are thought of as sort of the edge of the noble class. Noble class at a higher honor price, some other legal advantages. On the other hand, you also get the comment that that's in some ways a disadvantage, because if it's harder to sue a member of the legal of the noble class, that's a reason not to lend him money or not to do things where you to contract with him. Presumably, the bulk of the population was freemen. There's a distinction then between big farmer and small farmer, and there's this very detailed description of what how big the house is going to be and how many cattle and so forth for each of them, which surely cannot be true for every big farmer, but at least was again a sort of a stylized picture. And then the unfree would include people who were landless but free to move down to slaves. And slave could be somebody captured in war. It could presumably be somebody who ended up shipwrecked on the coast or something with no claims to anybody's hospitality. Or I think you could get enslaved as a result of legal conflicts, but I'm not sure.
You could be kidnapped from England, like say.
Yeah.
Kidnapped.
Yeah. But that's all right. The Irish got kidnapped Iceland. I gather that a lot of the X chromosome DNA in Iceland is Irish. Yeah.
Let's say you're in one of these systems and you have, I don't know, there's 3,000 people carrying their clan or whatever. And you must have hundreds of obligations. There's always things being settled. And you all share this. Who keeps the books? I mean, how is it that you know who to pay or how it's all, it's all done?
The answer is I don't know that. And we probably don't know. It may have been a memory system. It isn't clear to me how the Derbfin, or Derbfin, however you pronounce it, actually was controlled. That is, when you say, this is a group, who makes decisions for the group? And I don't think that's at all clear. Certainly it's not clear to me. All right, honor price. This is one of the interesting features of it. The honor price is defined for adult male freemen by their own status. So a king or a bishop, I think, have the highest honor prices, I remember. And then various nemed, depending on how many clients they have and whatever. For dependents, which would include a wife or a child or, I think, probably servants, I think they have half the honor price of the person they're dependent of, if I remember correctly. It determines how much you're owed for an injury to yourself. How much is owed to you if a kinsman is killed? If your kinsman is killed, the amount that the killer owes you depends both on how close the relationship was and on how high your, not his, honor price was. I should say that Gragas describes something like that at one point for Iceland, but I've never seen any evidence at all in any of the sagas that it existed. So I've actually wondered if somebody was actually copying something from Ireland or Wales that they thought ought to be in the law, but I don't know. It also determined how large a sum you could contract for. And it determined the weight of your oath and testimony. And again, I don't know, and I'm not sure we do know, how this worked. In particular, if your oath is worth 100 and mine is worth 60, can I get a friend who's also 60 to swear along with me and add him up? And I just don't know. But there clearly is some concern with the fact that high-status people is hard to enforce the law against, and therefore you have to be careful in dealing with them. Contracts. Private law you have a system of pledges where you sign a contract, you give something of value to you, so it's which you get back when the contract is fulfilled. So it looks like a hostage system. Now, if the thing is the equivalent of just a lump of money, then it's a little puzzling how it works when you have hostages in both directions, because why can't I just cancel it and you keep my hostage and I keep yours? And maybe the answer is that it's that the hostage I gave you is something of particular value to me and not to you. If you think my hostage is my son, for example, but I think that's not normally done in contracts, but that certainly is historically a common enough pattern. I won't diverge into the story of how William Marshall was offered as a hostage as a child and successfully survived because he was such a cute kid and went on to become the lord of about a quarter of Ireland through marriage later on. He's an interesting medieval character. But in any case, we know that they refer to these pledges. The surety system is interesting. There are a number of different kinds of sureties. A native surety is somebody who you appoint who has the right to use force to make you fulfill your contract. All right? So you are saying, I agree that if I don't fulfill my contract, that fellow, who presumably is going to be somebody relatively powerful, can make me fulfill it. And he won't owe me any damages for beating me up or whatever he does to make me do it. A Roth surety is somebody who has agreed that if you don't fulfill the contract, he will surrender himself to the other party as a hostage, who you then are supposed to buy back. And you then owe damages to him as well as the original payment. It's very unclear how this is functioning. And one possibility is that the Roth surety existed for contracts between kindreds or between two Oths, or perhaps that he was somebody who was sort of permanently had the position that if my kindred doesn't keep its agreements, he is supposed to turn himself over to the other people, and then we've got to get him back by payment. A lot of this is less clear than I'd like it to be. But for substantial contracts, both sides gave sureties of one sort or another, or several sorts. Maybe what's going on is that you're trying to entangle in the contract enough neighbors to make sure that it will be known what the contract was, because they are parties to it as sureties of one sort or another, and you'll therefore have to abide by it. But again, this is very speculative. One of the interesting features, which you also actually see in a way in Jewish law, is that you are limited in your ability to sign contracts if they might make you unable to fulfill a previous obligation. In particular, a son has an obligation to support his father in his old age. So under some circumstances, the father can cancel contracts the son makes if they might arguably make him unable to support him. And similarly, the son, I think under some circumstances, can, I think it goes both ways. Husband and wife. If the marriage was on the husband's property, then there are various categories of contracts the wife can make that the husband can dissolve. If it's on the wife's property, reverse. And if on joint property, either one can dissolve the other's contracts under some circumstances. And for the kin group, if I make a contract where if it fails, that might result in some of the group's land forfeiting, then the kin group can forbid the contract. Similarly, if I adopt somebody, that they can cancel that because that adoption would bring them into the kin group. So there's it looks like a fairly sophisticated system, which I don't think we know enough about. Enforcement. There's this elaborate procedure of what's called distraint, in which I claim you owe me a certain amount. I go onto your property with witnesses in a ceremonial way and demand that you either pay me what you owe or agree to arbitration. You don't. I go back again. Repeat. Third time I do it, I go to your cattle and start and remove one of your cattle and put it in a safe place that I've prepared. Next day I remove another. Next day I remove another. So it seems to be somehow a private action, but a private action taken in a sort of very slow and deliberate way in order to enforce claims. And eventually, you don't pay the debt, those cattle I confiscated are now mine. And it's unclear to me what counts as agreeing to arbitration. That is to say, how do we choose the arbitrator? Are there people who somehow the community knows are reliable arbitrators or what? And I don't understand. But again, you have this picture of an elaborate formal procedure and no adequate explanation to me of what's all me backing it. Nobles you apparently can't distrain, but you can fast against the noble. And this is sort of, we see this in hunger strikes in modern contexts. And apparently, while the plaintiff is fasting, the noble's not supposed to eat until he has either given a pledge or appointed a Roth surety. And if he does eat anyway, he owes double damages, but how you then enforce those double damages, I can't figure out. So, and death, injury, and feud, Wehrgeld is the same for every free man, does not depend on your status, but the payment to the relatives of the victim does depend on their status, on their honor price. In the injury case, the price for injury depends on the honor price of the injured person, but you also owe him sick maintenance. You're supposed to basically provide a physician, take care of him, feed him, and feed his retinue, if he's an important enough person who is entitled to a retinue, and make sure there are no small kids yelling in the near where he is until he gets better. That seems to have been, I think, composed for a money payment later on, but that originally was there. And part of what's neat is that also shows up in Somali law, although I didn't mention it, when you injure somebody. And we know the Celts got pretty far, but I don't think they made it to Somalia, so I assume this is parallel development. There is one of the scholars of Irish law who argues that some of the features of Irish law may suggest things that go way back to more or less Indo-European law, because there are features in common with Roman, which is not a Celtic society, as well as other Celtic societies, in particular the system of sureties. Enforced by feud, yes, if it is not paid, the offender can be killed or enslaved, so that's another source of slaves. All right, curial law. This is the other half of the system, which may or may not exist. A king, in one source, there's an elaborate description of a king's court, that there's the king, and there's his judge, and his poet, and these people over here, and these people over there, and very complicated. Maybe this is only for conflicts where the king is a party. Maybe this is an over-king or a provincial king, the next step up, dealing with conflicts between the local kings. I don't know. We don't know. Again, there's one source which has an elaborate description of five paths to judgment, where you basically, in effect, hire a lawyer, and the lawyer figures out for this case you ought to take this path, and then you've got to do this, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this. Only one source says that. It's not clear why you choose one or another. There's another source that has the king present at the case. What determines the judge? Does a Tuath just have one official judge? Is anybody who's believed competent, which is really the Somali system, we don't know. Supposedly, if a judge gives an unjust verdict, he will get supernatural punishment, and you have that idea running through bits and pieces of it. Is what we are seeing a system where the private law was the early system and the curial law would develop later? Did both coexist for different categories? Is it possible that the authors of our sources were trying to shift the system from one to the other? Is it possible that what you had was like the Icelandic feud system and all the procedures were ways of trying to settle and minimize violence? Is it that the king gives a judgment then it's privately enforced? It's got various similarities to the Somali. So that's my summary. It's an elaborate and sophisticated system in which you have very imperfect knowledge, including private and decentralized system, also a curial system. We don't know how they interact. So sorry, I can't give you better information, but that's what I got. Yes?
I'm surprised that it's so hard to find information about Ireland. Is nothing written, was not translated to English?
No, it wasn't written. That nothing has survived. The stuff that survived, the legal texts, there were legal texts in the 8th century and they have not survived. What we have are quotes from them in much later material. Then there are things like saints' lives, which sort of like the sagas, except the sagas are largely about legal disputes and the saints' lives aren't, so you can get some information from them.
Curial law.
Yes.
Is that church law?
No, law in court. Law in the king's court.
Oh, Does the church have their own laws as well?
Oh, boy. That's an interesting question. And I think part of the argument about what happens with Christianity is whether the law treatises were being written by monks who were trying to sort of combine things, or by people who were trying to have rivals to the church law. So let me go on to what is sort of, from my standpoint, is what's putting together stuff we've gotten through all of these. And this is the idea of feud as law enforcement. I want to claim the standard modern model of law we're all familiar with. All right? The law is made by the legislature or possibly by the judges in a common law system. The detection and prosecution of offenses is done by the government actors for criminal law, done privately for tort law. Disputes are resolved in government courts. The verdict is enforced by the government. That's what we all start out thinking of the way law works. Feud law is quite a different model. It's a model where law enforcement is private and decentralized. I want to claim that it's historically common, that arguably most legal systems started out as feud law, and in some form it still exists. That's the claim I'm making. In the book I have, I think before this chapter, I've got a nice quote suggesting that it was really the norm in medieval Europe, whether or not officially. And I should mention that the word feud has no connection with the word feudal. When I talk about feud, people start thinking, of course, talking about feudal law. It turns out if you look at the etymology, they come from different original terms. All right. The logic of feud law is very simple. If you wrong me, I threaten to harm you unless you compensate me. In order for it to work, it's got at least four problems, four that I can see that it has to solve. It has to have some mechanism, so I can't use that as a form of extortion. So I can't just say, I've invented a wrong that you did to me, I'll beat you up if you don't pay me. So you need what I think is some mechanism such that right makes might, such that it's at least easier to enforce my claim if it's really a just claim than if it isn't. You need some commitment mechanism, because when I say, if you don't compensate me, I will harm you, your reply is, you try to harm me, I'll harm you. All right? So therefore, why don't I back down? You need some way of making it in my interest, usually, not to back down, even when it's risky. And part of what's driving all of this is the fact that violent conflict is, on average, a loss for both sides. So if you know that I won't back down, you have an incentive to back down. But you'd also like to make me back down instead. Furthermore, you have to make my threat believable even after I'm dead. Because otherwise your obvious solution to my saying I'll harm you if you don't compensate me is then I'll kill you and now you can't harm me. So we need a commitment mechanism that lasts through death. We need a mechanism that protects those who are too weak to believably threaten retaliation. And we need a way of terminating feud, of avoiding a situation where perhaps each side thinks he's in the right, and therefore it goes back and forth. And Americans tend to think of feud in terms of Hatfield and McCoys. That story is almost entirely mythical. If you actually look at the historical facts, there was one member of one of the families got killed during or just after the Civil War, but there is no evidence that it had anything to do with the feud. He was on the Union side and the rest of the valley was on the Confederate side, and he got wounded and came home, which may have been a mistake. The actual feud part of that consisted of a fight at an election day party at which three young men of one family badly injured one young man of another family. The kin of the victim grabbed the three aggressors, waited to see if their relative would die, and after he died, killed the three. That was all of the killing that happens until 4 or 5 or 6 years later. Somebody sympathetic to the side of the three who were killed has influence with a state governor. And that state governor illegally sends a posse into the adjacent state to arrest the people who had done the initial killing. So essentially the feud had ended privately until the state intervened. But I discuss that in more detail in the book. But in any case, but it certainly is a possible situation. And they say in the Alsaga you do have this case of the back and forth repeat killings. You need some way of ending that. Mechanisms for right makes might. Saga period Iceland, the answer is basically a legislature, laws, and the court. The fact that if I win my case, then everybody knows that when I go after you, I'm the good guy. If I just attack you without having won a case, then you or your friends win a case against me. The Roman child gypsies, it's a system of informal norms where your friends will support you if you're in the right and not otherwise. That's why I said earlier that I see the Roman child, the modern Roman child system, as a primitive version of the 10th century Icelandic system. Somali, traditional law, ad hoc court mechanisms for determining who's in the right, and all of these solve two problems. They prevent the use of the threats for deliberate extortion, and they also prevent individuals from acting as biased judges in their own case, which is the obvious problem with a system of self-enforced law. Okay. Commitment mechanisms. I like to claim that, contrary to what many people say, property rights not only don't depend on the government, they precede our species. Because many species engage in what's called territorial behavior, especially birds and fishes, but some mammals as well. Territorial species, the individual somehow marks the territory he's claiming, turns a switch in his brain, is how I think of it, such that he will fight more and more desperately against a trespasser of his own species and sex coming into his territory. A fight to the death is a loss for both sides unless one side is much stronger than the other. So once it's clear that the territory is claimed and the defender will fight, usually the trespasser backs away. That, I would claim, is the primitive version of property, precedes our species by a very long time, and I think explains a good deal of what's actually going on in human societies. That I think of a whole bunch of human stuff as being a much more sophisticated version of that mechanism. I've got an article I could point you at which goes in more detail. So the way you see it in the human form initially is in the emotion of vengefulness, which people think of as irrational. If I stand up and bump my head, what is my first reaction? Anger. All right? There's nobody to be angry at. It's my own fault. But nonetheless, that's what I feel. That's hardwired into me. And I would claim that while in one sense it's irrational, having it as a hardwired instinct is not irrational, because the fact that if somebody wrongs me, I will very much want to get him is a good reason not to wrong me. All right? I don't know how many of you are familiar with the idea of a doomsday machine, as Herman Kahn invented it and shows up in Dr. Strangelove, but it's the idea that the U.S. could have simplified its protection against Russia. All you do is you make a whole bunch of really dirty bombs, dirty enough so that they all go out, off, life on Earth will end. And you bury them somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. And the trigger is a sensor that will sense a Soviet attack. All right? And now you don't need retaliation, you don't need any of the rest of the stuff. Because if the Soviets attack us, the world ends. We tell the Soviets, and so we're safe. And in Dr. Strangelove, the Russians do it, but they neglect to tell the Americans until a little bit too late. But in any case, that's a commitment. That's an extreme version of commitment strategy, and Herman Kahn described it because it was what we were really doing. We were just doing it in a much more complicated way, where we had bombers and missiles, and the people who could control those would shoot back whether or not it made sense to shoot back if the Russians did attack us. That's sort of the logic of mutual assured destruction, is the same thing. And I want to claim that fish and birds have mutual assured destruction too. They thought they invented it, we didn't, or if you like, evolution invented it. And you see it in terms of the emotion of vengefulness. But there are also external commitments for human beings. To begin with, if I don't carry through on my threat, now people will know I'm a wimp and I'm a safe guy to violate the rights of. And at the same time, human beings care about status, and being a wimp loses status. Success gains status, which is why in both the Icelandic and the Comanche case, you get volunteer enforcers. You get some big tough guy who says, I'll take over your case for you, I'll take care of this, and then basically faces down the not quite so big tough guy who was trying to bully you. How do you enforce your rights after you are dead? In Iceland, your kin inherit your claim. They have an incentive to enforce it, both to collect the money and to make it clear that other members of that kin group shouldn't be killed, because you'll get in trouble if you do. And in the Somali case, you have a prearranged DIA-paying group, which has an incentive, again, to enforce the claims even if their member gets killed. How do you protect the weak? I went through the Icelandic solution, which is very fond of. I like to claim this is a respect in which modern American law is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology, and I discussed various places the usefulness of some similar arrangement in modern law. In the Somali case, it's the fact that the group is formed by kinship and contract, so if the other descendants of my grandfather are tough guys, they have an incentive to protect my rights to claim on my behalf, and so forth. How do you terminate feud? What happens if I think you wrong me, you disagree, you refuse to pay damages, I harm you, you view that as my wronging you, et cetera, et cetera, and you can see the potential problem. Icelandic solution and a Somali solution. And there really are two Icelandic solutions. I don't really like the way and the Kali solution. The Icelandic solution, first you've got the law system, so if I retaliate with you without having gone through the court system, I'm now the bad guy and I now lose in the court. But in the additional method that you get in some other societies, as well as arbitration. So I don't want to back down. Because I think I'm in the right, but second, if I back down, people say, look at that wimp, he's safe to divide up the rights of. So I and the other guy find somebody who is powerful and respected and ask him to arbitrate, and we agree to accept his arbitration. If he then says, well, sorry, buddy, you're actually in the wrong, you owe them wear guilt for one of the guys you killed, then I can accept that because I'm not showing I'm a wimp, I'm only showing that I'm abiding by the arbitration that I agreed to, and furthermore, if I don't accept it, the other side now has a new strong ally, the guy, the arbitrator who I've just justified. So that's a solution. The Somali solution, I've already mentioned, ad hoc courts, and local enforcement of verdicts, but also the idea that you can raise the price of violence if violence is happening. The Kale solution seems to have been that when families were feuding, they just avoided any interaction with each other for, I don't know, 20 years or something, until people had forgotten the whole issue. I want to claim that feud law underlies many, perhaps most, legal systems. Anglo-American common law came out of Anglo-Saxon law, which is basically Icelandic law plus a king until about its last century or so. Rabbinic law has a number of pieces of what I think of as fossilized feud. If you, under rabbinic law, what's supposed to happen if you kill somebody is that you are taken to a court in the city where you killed somebody. If the court says that it was first-degree murder, so to speak, that it was a capital offense, you were to be killed by the avenger of blood. Who is the avenger of blood? The kinsman, probably the heir of the person you killed. If it's held to be sort of second-degree murder, roughly speaking, you are supposed to be escorted to one of the cities of refuge, and you remain there until the high priest dies. It's an exile of uncertain length. On your way to the city of refuge, if the avenger of blood catches you, he can kill you. Or if you are so imprudent as to go out of the city of refuge once you're there. Furthermore, there's some stuff in rabbinic law where you have, say, where it looks as though people are expected to sometimes self-enforce. So you have a case where it's unclear whether you owe me some money. And say we signed a contract and we were careless in drafting, and on one page it says you owe me 50 zoos, on the other page it says 100. And the court can't make you pay me 100. But if I have seized 100 from you, it can't make me give 50 of it back. That basically the court can only change the existing situation on good evidence, which it doesn't have in this case. Well, that implies that one of the things you sometimes do is to enforce your rights yourself. So I think there's at least some evidence that rabbinic law is built on top of a pre-existing feud system. Islamic law, as I mentioned, jinniyat, law for killing or injuring, is treating it as a claim by the kin, so it looks as though Muhammad simply interposed a court mechanism into this system, but what was a feud system? Roman law is very unclear. The our closest thing we have to a constitution is the law of the 12 tables, and like the Irish 8th century texts, it has not survived. What we have are parts of the law of 12 tables quoted in later things. But it is the case that in the early republic law, it's up to the plaintiff to drag the defendant to court, that the verdict gives him a right to seize, sell, or execute the defendant. There's some more stuff which I'm not going into in terms of law, what we've got of law of 12 tables. Again, if you look in, actually I may not discuss that. I've got an article in somebody else's, a chapter in someone else's book on this stuff, so it's probably not in the book you have, unfortunately. Modern forms of feud law. All right. First, there's informal feud law under the shadow of state law. So the Roman Chal I mentioned before, other Romani groups engage, in fact, in feud. So does the Sicilian Mafia, and so I expect the other groups. There's an interesting article by a sociologist who argues that a large fraction of homicide in modern-day America is really informal law enforcement. That is to say, among street gangs and things, why did we kill one of your people? Because you killed one of our people. But in addition, within the state legal system, there are things that have the same logical structure, even if you're using the courts rather than the swords to do your feuding with. So if you sue somebody who's innocent, that's a wrong. A suit in response is retaliation. And in particular, since we're in Silicon Valley, let's think about the logic of suing people for patent infringement. Suppose Apple wants to sue Samsung. And let's suppose, what doesn't at the moment seem to be the case, but who knows, that Samsung didn't really violate Apple's patents. However, Apple would still like to sue Samsung because the court might rule in their favor even if it's wrong. And while the suit is going on, people will buy iPhones instead of buying Galaxies. All right? Because you at least are less willing to buy a phone if it had to have various changes made as a result of losing a suit. But Samsung can sue Apple too. And that's a good reason for Apple not to sue unless they have a strong case. So in that particular feud system, the reason why right makes right is that the court systems get the answers right more often than they get them wrong. That's the basic logic of that system. There is, however, a problem. What happens in the Icelandic system if somebody has impenetrable armor, which nobody in Iceland had, but which various people in various medieval fiction have? There's this wonderful scene, and I think it's the Orlando Inamorato, where two men are having a duel, a Muslim and a Christian, and it's going on, and one of them says, look, I really want to tell you, you can't win this duel, I'm wearing impenetrable armor. And the guy says, well, that's very nice, very nice. I should probably tell you, I have impenetrable skin. Let's take the modern version of that. Suppose I own a whole lot of patents. I am what is called a non-practicing entity. I don't use any of those patents. I hold the patents because they let me sue infringers or people I claim are infringers. I threaten to sue you. You are innocent, but the court might make a mistake, and litigation is expensive, so you agree instead to pay me a licensing fee, even though you believe that what you're doing does not violate my patent. That's successful extortion. Now, if you are Apple, it's not going to work. All right. If you're a large company which is a repeat player in this game, then you say, I can't afford to let people extort me. I will bear the cost of fighting this case, and I will probably win the case, and then the next guy won't do it. But if you're a startup, and this case, even if you win it, may destroy you, and if you lose it, it will certainly destroy you, well, paying a little bit of tribute may be the more attractive option. All right. So this is a problem referred to as the patent troll problem in the literature. There are people at SCU and elsewhere who have written about it. There are people on both sides. Of course, the non-practicing entities people say, no, all we're doing is getting a decent revenue for people who have patents. Somebody invents something, and he's not a company, he's not going to do anything. So how does he get reimbursed? He sells it to us, and we then earn our money by enforcing the patent. But the alternative side is to say, no, all you're doing is accumulating lots and lots of patents in order that you can sue innocent people and extort from them. And we do observe that the big companies acquire a very large portfolio of patents, many of which they're not going to use, in order that they have weapons for suit, countersuit in this kind of conflict. All right? And because I don't practice any patents at all, I'm immune to threats of retaliation. For the solution to this problem, you're going to have to wait. I'm not sure if it's next week or the week after until we get to the legal system of Periclean Athens, which has a lovely institution, which I argue could be the solution to the patent troll problem. I didn't time it quite right this time, but do you have questions, discussions, comments you want to make, and so forth, because that's the end of my show. Yes?
You pointed out with those systems based on religious base that they are rather inflexible.
Yes.
It seems like the feudal system.
Feud system. Feud or feudal?
Huh?
Feudal or feud? They're two wholly different things.
Yeah, the feud system.
Yes.
Thank you. It seems like that's based on what feels like a natural inclination. Like
it's based on
it
what.
Says it inflexible as
it depends. In the Icelandic case, there is a legislature which can change the law. All right, the Icelandic case, you actually have an explicit law code memorized by the law speaker, changed if they want by the logretta, the legislature. So that's like our system in that sense. In the case of the Somali, on the other hand, what you really have is a set of a common perception of what traditional law is, and that can also change in the sense that if some new situation comes up and everything, we really don't like the application of the old rule to that system, so when a judge rules differently, we'll say, yeah, good judge, let's use them for our next dispute. So traditional systems can change, but they don't have a mechanism for deliberate change in the same sense. Though I should say, in the case of the Romani, we do have a case in California in the last 40 years or so where apparently a bunch of the Romani kin groups agreed to send representatives to a meeting in which they decided to make a change to traditional law, in part under the pressure of American law, which gave options to people who, to Romani who didn't like the Romani thing, and so they wanted to modify theirs, so that would be less of a problem. So it's not impossible, but I don't know of any. I don't know of an example. Well, I guess in the Somali case, we can take the situation that we were just told of, where. Yeah.
We're back to the
yes, doesn't matter though. We're finished. And what happens if I? Is supposed to be disconnected from that, right? So shouldn't that mean that I now have my mouse back? Probably not, but let's see. I don't have a mouse. Anyway, why don't you ask any questions you have for the next 3 minutes while I see if I can figure out what I'm supposed to do with this silly thing.
Power off. Power off. System off.
I'd just like to remind everybody, next week, Charney Hall, right?
We're not coming back to Charney Hall.